Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, the immaculate.
Now listen to this. I'll tell you about the heartache. I'll tell you about the heartache and the loss of God. I'll tell you about the hopelessness, the meager food for soul forgot. I'll tell you about the maiden with wrought iron soul.
Edition of Soma Time. The band's called Sparks, the year 1982, from the album Angst in My Pants, Eaten by the Monster of Love. Welcome to another Wednesday Night in the Sky, Sapiens. I'm your host, Dr. Mark. Number to call to Wine and Opine is 646-478-4847. Special show tonight. Obama's still yammering over there on all the networks that I can see. And so far, looks like we're all going to pay the insurance companies. I don't know why. I have to really listen to this later and digest it all. But he's not going to give us the public option. He's going to mandate we all get private insurance now, I guess. It's going the other direction. So okie dokie. Give us a little head fake there. So there's news. There's lots of news. But first, this is a special day here because it's almost like that part of Injustice for All where they go, you know, he thought he was gonna get him, I'm gonna get him, you know, and wow, I'm just looking at it just before I came on the air. So I just took a peek. And right now, if you go to Yahoo News, there's 101 news stories and 565 news photos about the swine flu. Here's a couple of headlines that might not have made your evening news. The NIH, mind you, okay? This is supposed to be a health-focused organization here, National Institutes of Health, expands the swine flu shots to test pregnant women. Time to test the new swine flu vaccine in pregnant women. Okay. Second and third trimester of pregnancies. China, as the Twitters come in, set to provide first swine flu vaccines. And now you have swine flu applications for your iPhone, so you can get the news on the go. The Queen canceled a visit to the schools based on the swine flu outbreak in London. Chinese devil dung plant could be swine flu fighter. I'm not even going there. The WHO. The WHO. Who are you? Warns of winter swine flu surge in Asia. Of course, there's a swine flu outbreak, of course, in the United States, as the college campus is open. Coincidence? I think not. Swine flu might hurt business, Harvard study says. Right? Business is wary of severe swine flu. Second wave of swine flu. I'm going to click on that, but that's from the AARP site. And I just want to see what they're up to over there because that's going to get the people paying attention. Let's see. The virus is still around and ready to explode. Well, there's not a panicky report from Vanderbilt University. We're looking at a big mess, he says. This is back in August. All right. So some of these stories are a little old. It's kind of comical, though. Well, look, he's done. He's shaking hands. He's taking his bows. He's his ahs. All right. So let's just get to the heart of this thing. What is this frickin' swine flu? What does it want from us? Because I'm sick of it. H1N1. CDC. Swine flu and you. So here we are over here at righthealth.com. Just taking a quick peek. See what they offer us here. They got a nice picture of Madonna. That picture of health at age 50. Secret to defying old age, you can get that. Swine flu is a flu virus usually found in pigs. The virus occasionally changes and mutates and becomes infectious in humans. Actually, it has a little bird flu in it if you read the wiki page on it. You can go to blogsome.net. I got all the links there. And there's just a whole bunch of symptoms here. You got, wow, dominant strain. Yeah, I don't know. I'm sick of talking about it, tell you the truth. I'm sick of talking about it. I can't tell you how sick I am. But the whole reason we're gathering here tonight, Sapiens, is to learn the other side of the story. You know, the side of the story that tells you that you are a host. You, the multicellular organism, have resistance, have the capacity to recognize intruder alert, and to see this thing for what it is, not what it isn't. So I'm moving away from that now. I'm going to go over to my side of the coin. And, you know, our guest coming up in a couple of minutes is going to explain this in more detail. But basically, in a nutshell, you have yourself and you have your surroundings. That is the somatic bridge across forever, constantly in exchange. There is no separation between an organism and its environment. I'll repeat that again. There is no separation between an organism and its environment. So that's why when we have situations like this that crop up, we have to understand that what they're doing is they're saying the surroundings are, are actually hazardous to the self, and we must take appropriate action. Now, we could take one way or the other. We could go the allopathic way. And the sons of allopathy have at their disposal the media, at their disposal the pharmaceutical company, at their disposal the insurance company, right? Because it's all about risk. And the at-risk groups get herded up first to get that shot, right? Because we can't have it going on in public places. That's the theme. We have taken health away from the individual and given it back to the public health people. And this is where we're going down a slippery little road here that could lead to some ugliness that we don't want to deal with. So tonight we're going to be, again, rolling back the veil and exposing some of the hidden things that haven't been given to you as a strategy to deal with what I perceive to be a little bit of a railroad job by the allopaths from the CDC, the Center for Disease Cheerleading.
You filthy criminals.
That's right, I just called them criminals. Come and get me. Because what I see it as is there's nothing more than them selling their stuff. For $8 a pop. You know, it's $20 a shot, actually, if you go and read about it. $20 a shot for these things, for the cost for the people buying the shot. I don't know what's going to cost to get the shot. So we'll go from there. Let's see if this doesn't cause any problems. Oh, that was a delicate one. All right. So, again, number to call tonight, because I want to answer the questions, too. I want you guys getting in. I'm going to open the chat room if I can. There's a delicate procedure here. Because once in a while, this little chat room causes problems. So I'm going to try and do that now. You guys have any questions you want to get to me during the show, you can always email us at nakedsoma@gmail.com and check in there before the show. I usually do. Didn't see anything before, so. And last week's little adventure into the chat room proved to be a little lonely move. But I'm opening up tonight because I kind of think that there's a little need to get a little discourse going here because people have, you know, limited perceptions of this thing. And every time somebody comes along and says, the boogeyman is now called this, you know, and go all the way back. Go back to the wake of 9/11 when everybody was running around, you know, with duct tape about anthrax, right? People put a little Parmesan cheese in the Metro North and they're jumping off at every stop around here. It's kind of kooky. These germs, they have no agenda. They're just trying to survive, just like you and me. That's the issue. Survival. Let's see. I'll give you the rules according to Elvis, okay? Just because he's here, so.
There's two things you need to know. Uh-huh. I'm the king, and number two is look out, man.
That's it. Great movie. Walk Hard. Check it out. So again, to just kind of recap what we want to get done tonight, I want you to understand what the swine flu is, what the opponent is, what you're up against, all right? It's a mongrelized virus. I love that phrase. That's what, just keep coming in. And I also want you to understand what you are, all right? Which is a self-regulating, self-healing organism that does not have to fear Mr. H1N1 or any other one of these bugs, whether it's SARS or MRSA or Ebola or the flesh-eating bacteria, dun, 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 whatever it is, it has no capacity to influence you other than the opportunity you give it by lowering your resistance. And most of that lowering of your resistance comes from what? Answer? Huh? You don't know? Your lifestyle. That's it. Most of your immune deficiencies become part of your lifestyle choices. Oh, I'm getting just hammered over here. All right. I have to shush the IMs here. All right. So with that as the backdrop, and that was quite a backdrop, we will now open up the Soma Submarine. Match, first go down. And welcome to the program. I can pop him up here, hit the button. There he is. Dr. Michael Lowe's from Arizona Way. Welcome to Summertime, Dr. Lowe's.
Thank you very much.
Did I guess right on the pronunciation? Is that okay?
No, it's pronounced less, just like Dr. More or Less.
Really? Wow. All right. Score one for you. I never would have got that from looking at L-O-E-S.
Well, if you see L-O-E-S-C-H, it's always Lesh. L-O-E-F-F-L-E-R is always Leffler.
Wow. All right. Well, there I get a lesson in phonetics. We didn't even get started yet. Okay. Well, I don't know about you. I watched about three quarters of Obama's speech. Did you catch any of it, or you were still working out there because it's kind of early for you?
I was driving back from Tucson to Scottsdale. So, no, I avoided the speech.
Oh, you avoided it. Okay. Yeah, good move for you. That's a long drive, Tucson to Scottsdale.
I don't think Swami Obama has much to teach me about health care.
Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Well, you didn't miss anything. The highlights, I guess, are going to be more felt in the insurance industry than anywhere else because he's making it illegal to do a bunch of things now, and he's going to force us all to get basic coverage. And I think the corporation is just one. If you want to talk about what came out of that speech. But I don't know. I guess I'm going to leave it to the pundits to interpret that. But back on dry land, where us humans have to sort of live our lives in this culture of allopathy that we were talking about before you got here, is that as long as you perceive your relationship with the environment as being adversarial, not complementary, any bug that they put a label on, like any hurricane they name, becomes the next threat, the next thing that's going to wipe us out. And I was talking about before you came on the air that it's not so much about the bug, it's about your response to it. And if you go into fear and you go into that defense mechanism that comes up, anytime I trotted out a bunch of names of boogeymen that have come and gone in the last 10 years, whether it's anthrax or SARS or bird flu or whatever they've done right here on the East Coast. We had the Western Nile virus a couple of summers ago. They were spraying everything, and the only thing that was dying were the rabbits and the birds, and the mosquitoes were laughing at it because they ended up having the wrong thing in the pesticides. So from your perception, and a lot of people out west, I mean, from the lens of the East Coast, you guys are the granola crunchers, you guys are you're the healthy people, the health nuts running and stuff at every corner, running in place, and we're sort of the last of a dying breed of, sedentary, sort of lazy people on the East Coast that just sort of would rather have the fast temporary relief than actually do the hard work of living well. So from a standpoint of both a practitioner, a researcher, an author, and all your expertise, what do you think the number one reason is that people can still get scared by the CDC and the WHO and the media about the latest, bug that's going to wipe us out, like swine flu?
Oh, I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, fear drives products. Fear drives a dependence on the government. Fear drives very bad health policy. And when the mistakes are made and when the vaccine side effects become called out, then everybody sort of steps aside and says it was for the societal good, but the individuals that were suffered from the vaccine side effects still have the rest of their lives to live. It's a very government proactive sort of societal wave of bad medical advice that tends to drive some very bad decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That. But a lot of times people are making their lifestyle choices within the confines of the doctor-patient relationship, and there's such lack of communication and connection between the lifestyle that the patient's living and the lifestyle that the doctor is offering them, and especially when you're dealing with a transition from a conventional, traditional lifestyle to one that is more holistic and has more, of a proactive approach. So what do you think the number one stumbling block is to have somebody transition when there is so much fear, when there is so much misinformation out there? What gets in the way of people actually owning the fact that they can do this independently of permission slips from, you know, Papa Government and Uncle Doctor?
Well, I think patients, people don't believe they can be healthy. They believe there's too many things attacking them, so they have to counterattack, and that's the whole basis for allopathic medicine, antibiotics, antidepressants. And when you have that sort of prevalent philosophy about health, you end up developing products with side effects, and you end up just cultivating a bunch of people who have a lot of drugs that are interacting among themselves and probably not doing a whole lot of good. In fact, I developed a concept years ago called the rule of decades. Mm-hmm. That means if you're 40 years old, 4 decades, you only get 4 prescription drugs. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, the society is worse than that. When I used to be director of a nursing home, average age 73, average number of drugs, 10.6. These are prescription drugs. So when we develop a culture that relies on drugs, we're developing a culture that is inherently toxic from those drugs and the combinations. So we have to move away into something more holistic, but you have to shift the belief that the healing power is within the person, not within the menu of what the pharmaceutical companies have to offer.
Right, and again, how do you get that across when from the prenatal point of life to all the way through to senior citizen care, it's constantly an outside-in, a bottom-up type of a culture where everything that comes to protect you and guide you through life comes from, you know, the outside, where there is no validity to an intelligence within or you know, you actually say the G word, that there's actually a relationship with God and spirit out there that is completely segregated from primary care. Because of the fact that we don't want to mix that, we don't want to mix those two things together. When most people have to in order to function in life, they don't have it compartmentalized. They live their faith and they practice their health habits, and they don't look at the two things necessarily as uncoupled elements. And so, how do you get? There's a lot, like I said, there's a lot of these barriers that they either don't get discussed or they get discussed in a very kind of like lip service way.
It always baffles me when you hear physicians talk about primum non nocere, which is of first accord do no harm, because the irony of that statement is that is the second law of Greek healing. The first law of Greek healing is respect the divine power of nature, and that we have within us divinely created is called the healing response, and the healing response is what our body does every time it's threatened or challenged to get us better safely, quickly, and completely, based on our knowledge, experience, and resources. And they're fairly well defined. They're not just taught, absorbed, and they don't come easily into our conviction system. And if they can do that, we have a path to get better reliably without relying on a lot of toxic drugs.
And, yeah, again, like I said, you're most people that come to those realizations have to get to an unlearning point where they take the Western model and it either fails them or fails people that they love, and they find these things under rocks. So what would be the first place? I mean, your book is a good summary of these principles, so we're going to go through them in a minute here and sort of give people an opportunity to kind of fly over the holistic terrain here a little bit. But what would be the first place someone would stop on the train, you know, especially when you're dealing with this relentless hype about H1N1, so they could start getting past some of these self-limiting beliefs?
Principle one is you have to have power. Ironically, we know a lot about physiological power. We know what our mitochondria produce through something called the Krebs cycle that produces energy that in fact gives us the vital force or vital spirit to shun things that are dangerous to us. So you'd be surprised how well we know that system, whether it's B12 channeling succinate into the Krebs cycle or whether it's phosphatidylserine that protects our membranes from oxidative stress or whether it's just plain loads of antioxidants to build up our mitochondrial function. That's where power comes. If you don't have physiological power in your system, you are fatigued, you're depressed, mm-hmm. you end up being swollen, bloated, and just not feeling well. So that's principle one, how to get power in the system, and when you do that, people begin to feel better.
Well, again, we've talked about this from a standpoint of just something as simple as looking at pH, you know, with some of our other guests and dealing with oxidative stress and dealing with alkaline versus acidity in the body. So, again, that never should become a problem to understand that the system needs power in order to function at its best. But people
when we have a vasoconstricted alkaline system, we don't function as well. In fact, principle two is that healing energy flows in one direction, that is the direction of healing. It sounds simple enough, but when you start to translate that into acupuncture terminology or jin shin jitsu or even basic massage, you got to push energy where it needs to be pushed. So if you've got congestion in the lungs and you start pushing energy in the right way, you can clear those lungs. And it may sound simplistic, but it's one of those universal truths. Push energy in the direction necessary to heal. Your body does it naturally unless it's blocked. So stop blocking that healing force we have within us. And certainly for viral syndromes, it becomes very key. You know, fresh air, deep breathing, right kind of humidity in the air, you know, makes a big difference in keeping people healthy.
It seems like a simple prescription. How come hardly anybody gets that in the culture directly? How come it just seems like that basic thing? I talk about breathe, move, and feel. If you can do those things in a fundamental and coordinated way, the way you act, relate, and express yourself becomes much more coherent. It just seems like those basic fundamental things are lost when something like an H1N1 comes over the horizon and everybody forgets, wait a minute, if I just do what I'm supposed to do here, me, the multicellular organism that self-regulates and all the things I'm able to do, we won't be subjected to this. And even if I got the flu symptoms, my body is just ridding itself of the toxins and getting itself back to homeostatic balance. Why is that a debatable topic between conventional wisdom or the model that everybody, a traditional model everyone knows, and the people out in the fringes, I would say like me, I won't say like you, that advocate things that are much more, I guess, in a real sense, simple?
Because common sense is not very common. We just came back from Vancouver, B.C. a few weeks ago, and my third daughter moved into a basement apartment where the humidity was just very, very high. And this is really a dangerous environment for mold, but she wasn't using her head too well. So what do you think the first thing we did? Went down to Home Depot and bought her a dehumidifier. If you start putting too much humidity in a basement apartment, you'll get mold. It'll be there, and you may not get real sick, but your whole demeanor, your whole general health begins to get clogged. So you have to have the right humidity. You have to have the right sunshine, and then you have to get the exercise and the food, and you do need some protections because unless you're really good with your diet, I think we're still, because of our planet being so toxic, we need to be guarded by some oxidative stress, which actually is principle eight in the healing response, guard against oxidative stress. In fact, a lot of naturopaths will say that's the only cause of disease, failure to protect against oxidative stress. So watch out for your environment, do the sensible things, cough up the $300 for a dehumidifier, and don't put yourself at risk.
Well, let's go through these principles. You got 11 of them here on the website here, thehealingresponse.com. I'll just read them off here quick. Principle one we already covered, which, again, this sounds a little bit religious-y when you read it, but as you described it, it's based on metabolics. Life, the vital force, is God-given. However, not necessarily God-maintained. Free choice exists. Build your vital force and your health ensues, and you talked about how to do that. And then principle number two, dynamic and specific directional flow of vital force results in homeostasis. I talked about that accidentally. Stability in the body, which is just the system is, again, self-regulating, enhanced directional flow of life springs. And then number three, the body will make every effort to preserve homeodynamics, word you don't hear much, and avoid stasis. rid stasis and healing happens. This gets into the ones that I love, which is principle four. We talk about it a lot here under the broad heading of living in the rhythm. But principle four, you talk about diurnal, lunar, and specific seasonal patterns. We got one coming up in a couple of weeks. Of energy flow exist. Again, this is the environment as an extension of the organism telling it to change its tune, to adapt, synchronize and tune into your healing rhythms again. Body clock stuff, we talk about it all the time on the show on TSM, dealing with the way coherence will shift throughout the day, throughout the lunar phases, throughout the month, throughout the season, and that will affect neurotransmitters, it will affect recovery cycles, all kinds of things. So that's the fourth principle. Those four are just there, probably filled the heads of anyone listening to the show to the point where they'd have to pull over and go, what? Because what are the principles of allopathy, by the way? Fast, temporary
Let me talk about homeodynamics, because that's
that's a good word. Pull that one out. That's a good one.
The chemical term is homeostasis.
Right.
That means the right equals the left, the scale balances, things seem to be in an equilibrium. The only thing it doesn't take into account is forward progress of time. That's where the dynamic means time. You have to adjust by doing corrective action as you move with this forward homeostasis. And you have to make an active effort to stay healthy. Any football player knows that. Those first 6-8 weeks of spring training, they're a mess. And once they get back their training, they're able to function at high performance. But if you don't take into account the positive things you need to do, you will throw out your homeodynamics, which is your optimal health. And there's another word used in the book called salubrity, which we use the adjective a lot, salubrious, but salubrity is the noun which means state of enviable health. So the whole goal of the book is that we need to quest for salubrity, state of enviable health. And to be biblical for a minute, in Genesis tells us that after Noah, nobody would live more than 120 years. And in Psalms, I think it's 78 or Psalm 80, it tells you that you live to be 70 and 80 if you're strong. So I always challenge people to say, God said 120, Solomon said 80, so who's right? God's right, and we're throwing away 40 years because we're living in a toxic planet. So I actually think we're programmed to 120, and I forget the author's name of the Blue Zone, but he makes a fairly good argument that there are places in this world that really foster the reality that man is programmed to 120. And because of our toxic planet and the things we do, we basically give away 40 years.
Wow. And again, when you deal with the country getting older and the average age of disability getting younger, and the fact that that the interventions are becoming more and more heroic, that just little riff you just had there, I mean, should be again, to me, it's fascinating how none of this stuff gets a lot of attention. But the swine flu, and you know, and the queen not going to visit the schools, that gets attention. Again, you're dealing with a sensationalized culture that only deals with the buzz. It doesn't deal with what's actually happening. And I just get concerned that kind of message is just never going to get through in time to help enough people get out of the way of what I look at as being an oncoming train.
Let me re-hit the nail on the head on Chapter 4. This idea about body clock and body rhythm, I do always tell people the most important chapter is Chapter 4. You got to go to bed at 10 o'clock and get up at 6, or go to bed at 11 and get up at 7. You need 7 to 8 hours of rest. And we have a virtual epidemic in this nation right now of people who don't sleep. I am currently the director of the pain division at Sierra Tucson, which is a nationally known rehabilitation center north of Tucson, where people are brought in with psychiatric drug and pain problems for 30 to 45 days. To detox and get better. It's in the high desert of the Tucson area. And let me tell you, we see a lot of messes. And we see probably 90% of those people coming in with train wreck sleep patterns. And those are one of the toughest things to rehabilitate. Our friend Sidney Baker wrote a book called The Circadian Prescription, which is so simplistic we miss the reality. No coffee, tea, chocolate after 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Don't eat beefsteak and alcohol at 8 or 9 because it throws your gallbladder into a tizzy, and then you don't sleep and get to sleep till 1 o'clock because your gallbladder and then your heart have to pick up the slack. because there's something called the Harari clock and acupuncture terminology that tells you, unless you're kind to your gallbladder and your heart, they will keep you up till 1 o'clock in the morning. And when you're very unkind to your heart, you'll have a heart attack at 12:30 at night, which is, in fact, the most common time of the day for heart attack. We know this stuff, so we need to respect it and move forward.
Well, it just sounds like, again, like that there's so many, like I said before, that it's the lifestyle habits that lower our resistance. And people are addicted to those lifestyle habits. So even though they may know this intellectually, putting their feet under it might take them 5, maybe 10 years of really difficult, tough sledding when there's hardly any support out there. Because if you told those things to the average medical doctor, his hands would be on his hips. He wouldn't believe you. Because he's trained to look at things in a very, you know, third person and almost Newtonian way, and their interventions are even more twice removed from the client, because they never deal with the client. They deal with this entity called disease that, you know, I think it was 60% of the time, I forget the study, on autopsies that they got the cause of death wrong. You know, nothing's moving, and they still don't know how to get labeled the suckers. So, again, this goes back to my original concept, but the public has this very vague idea of what defines health, especially when you get into the nooks and crannies, like what wellness is, which is self-reported, or well-being, which deals with vitality and things like that. And you go even further out to sea with this concept of salubrity. And I just get concerned, again, that, well, I talk about things like coherence and entrainment, which are outside of, you know, the loop even more, and go even further out to something like Antonovsky's concept of salutogenesis, the origin of well-being. So how do we make all these concepts easy and portable? Because disease seems to be real easy to get a handle on, and all these other things seem like they're very slippery. They're kind of like vague.
Well, it starts with our poor medical training. I mean, you will go to a doctor right now as a smoker, and your cholesterol will be 220, and he'll put you on Lipitor or some sort of drug for your cholesterol. When in reality, if you stop smoking, your cholesterol will go down 10 to 15% in less than a week, because smoking dehydrates you, causes vasoconstriction, not to mention screws up your sleep cycles, acidifies your blood, decreases oxygen in your tissue. But the doctor will write the prescription for Lipitor, and your insurance will pay, and you may or may not live any longer. But it's just that's how they're programmed. Patients are programmed to come into the doctor, see an abnormal number, and get a prescription. And, in fact, it's quite hard for a doctor not to write the prescription, because the prescription is closure. It's like the final sale in a real estate transaction. You write the prescription, you walk out of the room. But it's so baffling to me. And then we turn around and watch Obama talk about all our health care expenses, which are very real, and they're very horrific for many, many families, because I think it is out of control. But the answer lies more in preventive health, and the answer lies in maybe some changes of the resources that we have available, and certainly maybe a decrease in some of the expectations. Because I will tell you that I've been working at a free clinic a couple days a month, and it's quite horrific, and the poor population sometimes are worse than the rich population that are educated and should know. What I see in a free clinic is obesity, hyperlipidemia, hypertension, and diabetes, day after day after day. In fact, there's a book by Schwarzbein called The Schwarzbein Principle that predicts by next year, I think her number is 30% of Americans are diabetic, and it is totally preventable. And it's one of the most expensive diseases we have to treat. And if we don't get a handle on that, we're duck soup in terms of our budget.
Yeah, and again, this is a runaway train as far as I'm concerned, because the population you're talking about is already in either precursors, or they're in stage one or stage two of some of these pathologies, and arresting and reversing them usually is going to involve conventional medicine first till it fails or produces other side effects that put them on stage one or stage two of other pathologies. So by the time they get to someone who's dealing with enviable health and salubrity and happiness and sunshine, they're in a clinic like yours, or they're in a chronic pain situation. So take the next generation that's coming along that maybe are the children of the people that maybe tried to adopt some of these holistic principles in the last 20 or 30 years. A lot of them were able to kind of avoid, like my kids, they're in their teens now, never been vaccinated, don't take over-the-counter medications, you know, have a diet that fits their constitution, maybe adopted a couple of things from the other six continents of the world, you know, that don't have the resources to pour all these drugs down their throat, and they don't have a concept of their bodies being broken and insufficient. They understand they can, and one of my kids has special needs, and my other kid is on the gifted and talented side, so I'm jumping ropes with the educational system and the healthcare system here. How do you get those parents to kind of almost create a little bit of a community out there? Because what I see is a constant sort of duck and cover go on, because all the organizations I've ever talked to, especially out here on the East Coast, the ones that are picking a disease of choice, like an autism foundation or something like that, seem to be funded and sort of alive with, we just want different medication, or we just want better medication, or we just want access to these kinds of things, these kinds of services. So you're in that milieu of these foundations and stuff. So on the other side, on the board of these foundation side, how do you get that very basic, very inexpensive, a message that can be propagated easily? How do you get that through all the bureaucracy without it being filtered?
Well, I have a solution, and if Obama ever called me, I'd give him advice.
Okay,
is you got to put the healthcare dollar back into the consumer. And the American Academy of Physicians and Surgeons have argued that for a long time. I think employers probably should pick up catastrophic insurance, maybe a $5,000 deductible, and then give the family the $5,000 incentive at the end of the year for staying out of trouble, and then make sure that healthcare dollar is in the patient's hands. Because believe me, patients are pretty darn smart about what they'll pay for, and they will actually look for things that are reasonably cheap and of high value. The second thing is you do have to hit the school systems hard, and you have to make sure that there's some vitality in the diet. I mean, whoever did the movie Supersize Me should someday get a Nobel Prize for peace and for health,
mm-hmm.
because he did change the way America eats. Has it totally changed it to the benefit of obtaining salubrity? No, but he made a big dent. And if you have advocates like that who embarrass big companies that certainly make it difficult to be healthy, I think you can make a difference. But it has to start in the school systems, has to start in the fast food restaurants, because that's where a lot of people eat, has to start in the supermarkets where things have to be fresher and our American farmers have to produce what's needed for good health. And it has to do with maybe some assurance that there's health care out there when you fail to get you the surgery you need or get you back on the curve to getting healthy again by your own means. And I think it can be done without just force feeding us with a new healthcare system that's government driven.
Yeah, well, again, I just popped up the text of Obama's speech here while you were talking there, and it doesn't sound like we're going in that direction, Doc. It sounds like we're going exactly 180 degrees from there, but if anyone's interested, Yahoo News has it already up there now, and just to give you a clip of what we're talking about here is the plan. He finally gets to halfway through the speech. This is the plan I'm proposing. It's a plan that incorporates ideas from both sides of the room, of course, Democrats and Republicans. And for the most part, what he's saying is that insurance companies can't drop people because of pre-existing conditions. They can't drop you because you lost your job or changed your job. But the public is now basically, everyone has to carry basic coverage. So you can't claim you're uninsured because there's no more options. So what will that entail, and what will that, how will that be regulated? I guess that's going to be decided for now when the bill comes in. But
language for governing a health care plan.
Yeah.
And, there's an argument called, are you on the side of the pest or the pestilence? Now, it's kind of a difficult argument to say on a radio program, but it basically says, are you on the agenda of society or are you on the agenda of the individual? Well, as a physician, I'm the physician for the individual patient. I'm not a societal kind of politician, even though I write with some suggestions that should be taken more widespread. But that individual patient does have some, I hate to use the word right, but does have some or should have some availability to get themselves out of crisis. But on the other hand, if you're going to pound the group of individuals with some sort of powerful public policy, you're going to miss the reality that we live in a nation of freedom where people should be empowered to make the right choices and have reasonable options available to keep themselves out of problems. When the government gets too handy in our pockets and in our policies, we find out that we lose one of the basic individual freedoms that we have, and that is our individual right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of freedom, and the pursuit of health without having it rammed down our throat by a mass vaccination process.
Thank God. I mean, I get concerned because what I see this going with this H1N1, because of things like WHO and of course, CDC backing that up, is that they're shifting the focus from individuals, and I'll read you the quote right out of Obama's speech here in a second, to this notion that everything becomes a public health hazard. So now they bypass your choice and say, you're here, if your kids are going to go to a public school and they're not going to get this vaccine, we're not going to let your kid come to school. Not because of your individual choice, but because this is a public health hazard. So again, personalize and they externalize the choice and make it a group thing and make it a blanket thing. And that's the way they get their agenda pushed through, because they know they can't sell all of us on this individually. We're going to be looked at as being, you know, the people that are objectors or, you know, subversives, if you get even down to the nitty gritty of it. Because the backup plan to that is to go to the Patriot Act and say, well, this is a biological hazard, and if you're not vaccinated against it, then you become a vector. And we have to put you in a special part of Wyoming until the vaccine is distributed properly, or the pandemic passes, or both. And
that's
it sounds,
the idea of the pest versus the pestilence. The pest is sick. They're the individual person. But let me repeat this, that the flu is not tuberculosis. The flu is not tuberculosis. When I was a director of internal medicine at the Student Health University of Arizona, I had a young woman from one of the Oriental countries who came in. She had a big cavity. She had TB.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed to culture the TB. She wasn't coughing up. And so I wrote the order for the endoscope and bronchoscopy. And she refused. She said, I'm not getting that endoscopy. I'm not letting you put that down my throat to get a biopsy or a culture. And I had to look at her and I said, you don't understand. Tuberculosis is a legal disease. If you deny this procedure, you're going to get deported. So, I mean, there are some times when you have to sort of look at the situation and say, you look like you got TB. We got to figure out how to contain it. So you're going to have to go under the legal mandates that keeps our country safe. But the flu is not tuberculosis. And so I think we have to realize that we have innate means of getting ourselves better and keeping ourselves well without inviting another potential public policy hazard down the path.
Now, here's Obama's statement to that end, okay? It says, under his plan, individuals will be required to carry basic health coverage, just as most states require to carry auto insurance. Businesses will be required to either offer their workers health care or chip in to cover for the cost of their workers. There will be a hardship waiver for those individuals who can still not afford coverage. And 95% of all small businesses, because of their size and narrow profit margin, will be exempt from these requirements. We cannot have large businesses and individuals who can afford coverage game the system. Again, you're subversive. By avoiding responsibility to themselves or their employees, improving our healthcare system only works if everybody does their part. So unless you're all part of the allopathic system, the allopathic model, you are gaming the system. You're taking advantage, and then we have to pay for your emergency room visits and all the irresponsible behavior. So he's tagging the people that don't participate, not because they can't afford, but because they don't elect to. Because they might live a different lifestyle. I don't rely on 24-hour drugstores to keep me healthy. But for some reason, I'm gaming the system in this model that he's talking about here. So it's interesting to see how they play this down as things progress and that vaccine comes over from Europe. I guess it's in October. That the colleges are already calling for it, because they just got back to school and everybody's freaking out. And you've just got, like I said, you've got this consciousness of the only solution is vaccine for something that's a self-limiting condition. And how many years in a row have they gotten the flu virus, the flu vaccine wrong? Because they seem to think these things are static. They're adapting as well as we are. So, and then the shelf life of the doses and all that stuff, it just seems like a mess. And you know, getting back to your principles here, which is where we kind of jumped off there. Principle 5 is the intelligence is in the cell, and we have to
absolutely
feed that cell.
Michael Gershon wrote a book called The Second Brain. And he actually focuses on the enteric plexus as the smartest cells in the body. It's not in the brain, it's in the gut. In fact, mm-hmm. it's sort of ironic that the Greeks would say that your gut was where your vitality was. In fact, it was actually in the splanchnon, which is your spleen filter. That's the Greek philosophy of medicine. And it mm-hmm. filters and it recognizes and it takes out at the cellular level in the gut to really help protect you. And I think it's so massively important to realize that. And when we do that, wow, we can be a whole lot healthier by just respecting our gastrointestinal tract.
Just,
and not
just mentioning there's an enteric nervous system is a revelation for most of us listening in. So we'll hopefully understand there is a brain in the gut. There's actually a cardiac brain. There's a lot of brains out there within your system, brains within brains. But we have a caller here from area code 862. Let's see if you're listening or you have a question for the doctor. Go ahead. You're on Somatime. Are you there?
Hello?
Area code. Yes, hi. Area code 862.
Oh, no, I'm just listening. I'm just listening. Thank you.
Oh, okay. We'll put you back on hold. Enjoy the show. I don't even know where 862 is. It might be out west somewhere. Sometimes we get people driving
let's
home.
Let's jump into, as you say, there's 11 principles because there's an interlude chapter. And that's a chapter about the solvent and the solute, which means is it more important to have healthy water, which is the solvent, very important.
Uh-huh.
In fact, it needs to be mineralized water, or the stuff that's in the water, which is the solute. So when we have things in water that help us with our electromagnetism, like various minerals, and when we have the right kind of things dissolved in the water that flows through our body, whether it's the necessary glucose, whether it's necessary other minerals and micronutrients, we can, in fact, effectively bathe the body. And there's that very excellent book called The Body, Many Cries for Water, about body dehydration as being a major cause for disease mm-hmm. by Dr. Bhattamanji or something as it's pronounced. It's a long name, but very, very thoughtful book. In fact, his website's watercure.com. He talks about the vast importance of cranking up your water so that, in fact, you can filter, bathe, and appropriately excrete what needs to not be there. And it's so simple, but even the football players of the major pro teams are being told liquids are not the same as water. You can't mm-hmm. necessarily get your water content up by drinking tons of Gatorade or certainly coffee, tea, and hot chocolate. It just doesn't do it. You need the purified solute, solvent, which is the water.
Well, understanding that, 80% of your brain is water and, when most of your body is water, there's another one of those things that seventh grade biology that slips through the cracks. By the time you get out living an adult lifestyle, you rely on things that are not really, life enhancing. And like I said before, once you hit about 30 years old, some of these habits become so ingrained that they're addictive and you spend most of your middle years and adult life fighting off these patterns because of the fact that the strategy was joined you already in progress as you're hurtling down towards the allopathic paper trail into pathogenesis. So there's principle 5, intelligence in the cell, know what feeds the cell, and that leads to health. Principle 6, we're almost halfway through.
The cells talk with each other.
And the cells are talking. Oh, that's another thing. Communication is another thing. We talk about in somatics about the core versus the cortex, the involuntary part of the system versus the voluntary part. Cells and tissues, as it goes up the scales, into organ systems and then all the way into organism, is just a simply conversation on a different scale. And so we get into the principle 6.
We actually know a lot about this.
Oh, yeah.
The transmitters are primarily enzymes.
Uh-huh.
And the actual activator molecules are called growth factors. So when something's happening in our homeodynamic system, it's recognized, enzymes recognize it, kick in with the cellular intelligence, go to the growth factors to kick in the fibrin here, the insulin there, the growth factors here, and it actually works. I mean, it is divinely made. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. And it really does help correct itself unless you don't let it. So if you're one of those people on a ton of proton pump inhibitors that totally screw up your GI tract and will definitely make you B12 deficient and will definitely keep your acid, your body way too acid, you should have a cellular intelligence system where cells are communicating back and forth.
Right. And that's really the law behind Principle 6, as you say here, open all lines of communicating to the cell via vital exchange, the principle being that the brain provides one level but not the only level to support the cell. So just like politics, all communication is local in the organism. And then you get, now you start crossing over to a little of the abstract way. But first six principles, a lot of meat on the hook. We could put a knife in a lot of these things and say, here, look, there's a cell and there's a cycle and there's some homeostasis, there's some metabolism here. Principle 7, we start getting into a little bit of the mental component. Our beliefs create a unique biology. Just that statement alone should be a bumper sticker within us that creates behavior. Equally true is that behavior creates biology, which creates belief. If you optimize the healthy beliefs and behavior, you get a faster healing response. Explain that one.
Well, both ways work. I mean, I just drove up from Sierra Tucson, which has a ton of cognitive behavioral therapists. If I can make you think the right way, you will find my argument convincing and you will change your behavior. It does work to a certain extent. Education, fear, and peer pressure are things you learn. You change your thoughts and it changes your behavior. But if I just happen to drop off my daughter to the Marine recruiters and she just happened to be out of shape and not in very good health and I just dropped her off and said, no, you're not living here anymore, the Marines would say, okay, I'm going to shave your hair, put a hat on, put your boots on, go to boot camp. 12 weeks later, your physiology would be changed, and you would walk out of that boot camp and say, yes, sir, I'm a Marine. So that other way, that developing habits, the change in function, definitively changes the way you will have beliefs. Some of it's just automatic. I mean, with this recent job I just took down in Tucson, the campus is huge. I walk all day. I mean, it's impossible to get overweight on this place because it's huge. So when you change jobs sometimes and you actually decide to not drive your car and to walk the 2 or 3 miles, you'll find out that that function will change your beliefs, will change your physiology, which in turn will change your beliefs. So they both work. Yeah, the point is, use them both. Don't just go to the psychologist and sit in the chair and think he's going to change your behavior and your physiology and beliefs and you're going to be healthier. You got to do them both.
And again, the fact about having a healing response that has different rates, we talked about that with your buddy Dr. Petrus about 3-4 weeks ago, that just like people that are out there that are fast learners, there are people out there that are fast healers because they exploit that principle and are able to shift beliefs, behaviors, and all the things in between that affect their biology in a more fluid and coherent way. And again, this is another aspect of what we call the somatics entrainment, where your system is going to tune into the most coherent source of adaptability, which segues into Principle 8 here, which is the environment induces another one of these things that everyone walks around, oh, my genes, I'm predisposed to this or that, and there's an environmental trigger that will activate that. And you talk about living in a healthy environment and protecting against oxidative stress. We talk about that at the top, that the environment will drive the metabolism to mobilize its resources, and when those resources aren't there, your body will develop a residue, which becomes a source of chemical stress, which in our parlance would be inflammation, which everyone takes anti-inflammatories for because they're loaded up with lactic acid because their body was failing because they weren't breathing well in the first place, and then they got taxed by the chemical or physical environment. So talk about how Principle 8 works on a much more macro level, not just gene expression, but how that creates cycles that would lead to disease.
Well, you've probably at some point had a functional medicine doctor or two on the show, functionalmedicine.org. Jeff Bland was sort of the founder and president of Metagenics. The functional medicine people will say you have antecedents, you have triggers, and you have mediators. Certainly when you have these genetic background, but the functional med mantra is genotype does not predict phenotype, which means your genetics account for only probably 20% of what you manifest in disease. So it's a minor component. But you do have a genetic basis on some issues. But then those triggers, certain things will trigger, and certainly toxins will trigger certain responses, whether it be inflammation, whether it be some cognitive decline, whether it be depression or sleep problems. Those are triggers, and they may be mediated by certain molecules. Candace Pert wrote the book called Molecules of Emotions. Mm-hmm. When you have something happen, it triggers certain responses, some of them favorable and some of them not so favorable. Some of them have to play catch-up and some of them have to protect. So the whole idea of oxidative stress is as old as the hills. Most oxidative stress are caused by free radicals coming from fractionated oxygen particles that are electrons without a place to land, and if they can't be buffered and protected, they land on membranes and they create craters, and those craters make it difficult to communicate across the membrane, and so you get fibrosis, sclerosis, poor communication, and bad health. So that whole scenario from the failure to protect against oxidative stress, and it's a great argument for a unifocal cause of disease, has to be stopped by, again, hydration, lots of antioxidants, bioflavonoids, meaning fresh fruits and vegetables, and it's not a pattern that we have a lot. But if you can stop that in its tracks, as the functional medicine people will say, the dis-ease in the beginning is minor. It eventually becomes pathology, and if you can stop it in its tracks by understanding the nutritional biochemistry, you can arrest the trigger so you get the homeodynamics back in your system. Easy argument, hard to implement.
Yeah, and again, we've seen some of these things get some traction, like out here in Connecticut, we have Dr. Diadamo with the blood type approach, and now he's gone on to the genotype dive, which deals with the epigenetic aspect, which is of how our behaviors influence the gene expression again, creating another chemical environment that would promote coherence and better communication and reduce that load of free radical things you're talking about. So that segues into principle 9, which is toxins exist which assault our structural integrity internally and externally. Our physical and energetic body must constantly rebuild, shield, and actively defend itself, which is part of the infradian rhythms that we talk about here in somatics, which deal with growth and repair and tissue kinetics and how things replace. You know, sometimes, you'll hear an injury in a football game and they'll say, he's out 6 to 8 weeks. It's like, why do they pick that? Well, those are the tissue kinetics for repair from a sprain injury, because ligaments take 2 weeks to replace and usually takes about another 4 to 6 weeks to get some soft tissue integrity back if you put weight on it. All of those replacement cycles are mediated by the first 7 principles that if they're not intact, then you're going to get relapse, re-injury, or both, and more
if you
and
have
repair.
If you have that sprain, number one, don't take steroids. Don't take NSAIDs because they tend to block inflammation prior to putting fibrin down in the healing response. You got to hydrate. If you want to accelerate the communication, take proteolytic enzymes. You can go in any nutrition store and find proteolytic enzymes. So they're kind of called anti-inflammatory enzymes, even though they're not really anti-inflammatory. Mm-hmm. But what they really do is they modulate healing through growth factors, and you will see digestive enzymes, and you will see anti-inflammatory enzymes, which are generally papain, trypsin, chymotrypsin, and rutacid, and bromelain. And these are the formulas that we know enhance healings. In fact, in the book I wrote called The Aspirin Alternative, a lot of these sprains and foot fractures, they will heal in 3 to 4 weeks if they're accelerated by principles behind enhancing growth. And so I think that 8 weeks is very arbitrary, and it's very individualistic. And I think
Again, it's like a lot of things that have been normalized, like everything from body temperature to blood pressure, neurological function. A lot of these things are based on bell curve, statistics, and not an individual baseline. That again can vary and will vary over time within the individual and from the degree and extent of the injuries. It's another one of those things. Like, that's why when it comes to something like something as simple as bone repair and fractures, that there's still a resistance out there, which is a weird term for this, but to using magnets to promote bone repair. When it's always been an orthopedic thing. And they don't understand that the field is actually repairing the tissue, not the actual chemical components of the bone. They can only align based on the dynamics that are within that matrix. So there's so much, like I said, there's so much to me excluded, which now you're going even higher here, because we've gone from physical metabolic stuff to chemical stuff, a little bit of belief system stuff. By the time we get all the way up to principle 10, we're sort of going into the abstract completely here. You say this is something that, again, might be looked at as being crossing the line, but vitalistic stuff gets a little bit nutty. a strong connection with God, according to your understanding, again, we're getting to higher levels of beliefs here, positively influences your health and aging. Having spiritual health, another thing that's not really talked about a lot, will slow the rate of aging and dramatically lower incidence of many diseases, the law being you can accelerate your healing and slow aging at the same time by having a spiritual reservoir, which tunes into communal health, not just personal health, and deals with relationships, not just with yourself, but with your environment and also with these higher powers. So talk about how people can embrace that without getting stuck in the science versus religion well.
I'm going to springboard back for just a second to 9.
Yeah, go ahead.
Make sure it's simpler than you may have stated it. In Chapter 9, if you break a bone, you better have the right ingredients in your system available to heal it. Calcium,
right.
Magnesium, boron, vitamin D. If you don't have that in your system, you will not heal the bone.
Yeah.
The most common nutritional deficiency in the United States was magnesium.
Magnesium.
Now
right.
Dr. Hollick argues that, no, it's vitamin D. Some people argue that, no, it's essential fatty acids. You need all three of those things to heal. And so the simplistic thing in Chapter 9 is you got to have the right kind of elements to heal. Now, you mentioned the magnets, and some of you have read Baker's Body Electric.
Yeah.
Becker. Body Electric Cross Currents. If you put the cross currents on the salamander after you take a limb off, you put them one way, it doesn't grow. You put them the other way, it grows. There are sophisticated electronic magnets out for back surgery right now, and they work. These bone stimulators are magnetic principled, and they do work and should be used more. So the information behind magnets, again, when you get below the tabloid information, is pretty darn solid. Now, Chapter 10 quotes a lot from Larry Dorsey's book, which is the idea that prayer heals. And I think it quotes also from Gladys McGarry's book, The Idea of the Healer Within You is Important, and that needs to be spiritually connected. I don't think it's heresy or poor policy or crossing the line to say that healing, praying, and connecting to the divine powers in the universe, whether you're a believer of the secret, meaning the universe owes you something, or whether you're a believer in Jesus Christ as the mediator, you know, we can pick our belief systems, and I have certain convictions regarding those, but I'm not here to discount other people who know how to connect and get what they need through the love of family and the love of God, and throw some laughter in there too, because these positive energies indeed make us heal, give us harmony, and we do know that the people who live into their 115s, they do have God, family, love, sense of purpose. And if they live beyond 120, they always have one thing in common, and that is poor birth certificates. Because I think we were designed, we run out at 120, because the Bible tells us so in Genesis chapter 6.
Oh, okay. It's in the book. Well, I just pulling over there, because anytime someone kicks the secret, I like to gloss over that again. That the concept in the secret being that the universe owes you something. I love that summary of what's become a very popular and very dangerous meme, as we've talked about just this recently with Dave Lacani on the show a couple weeks ago, who was raised in a cult community in Montana and outgrew it and left it and now debunks these things. And the secret has done more of a disservice for something as simple as the law of attraction than probably anything I've seen in the last 5 or 6 years, and we regularly beat that one up. So thanks for that. And maybe someday we'll have Abraham and Hicks on here to explain it a little bit more in depth. But
I do believe you do reap what you sow.
Yeah,
if you put your passions in the community, you do build up your vital spirit, which to me is the core of your identity.
Right.
And in fact, that radiates with love and compassion around you. And so you do reap what you sow, but the infinite universe without a mindset conviction similar to mine, I don't think owes you something. But certainly if you work hard, you can reap the benefits of that. And so I'm not here to say that that doesn't work, because often it does, particularly if it's bent with compassion and respect for other people.
Well, I just like to rip apart that notion that in the secret of when people get into the create your own reality business, my somatic horns go up, and we have to go down that road a little bit. So, you know, that's principle 10. And again, the book goes through these things in layers, where you get a principle and a law. So you get both the theory and the application in one little tight chapter. So this one, you know, again, if all you're doing is meditating, if all you're doing is relaxation response, if all you're doing is biofeedback, that counts. That counts in terms of Principle 10 to both slow aging and accelerate healing. So it leads you to Principle 11, which is kind of the bonus principle here, which is every action is followed by first a reaction, then a response. And there's a distinction between a reaction and a response. Our holistic bodies do things that we don't understand, a lot of stuff we don't understand. We often react doing things we shouldn't, and then we end up worse off. Wait to heal and take the knowledge in the patient. So explain how people can have that much awareness that they can actually view a symptom as a blessing and not react and try to push it back down when the body responds this way.
Well, anybody who's married intuitively understands this principle.
Oh, okay.
So
how's that?
The issue is you need to respond appropriately and hold back on the checkpoint of the reaction. At Sierra Tucson, we work on this a lot with somatic experiencing and just turning off these ab reactions that tend to be reflexes. So if we see a particular kind of image, it channels something through us. If we bring up a particular memory and we try to pay attention to why are you responding that way? It's a caterpillar. I mean, why do you think this thing is going to kill you? And so when we start to train our ab reactions, our immediate reactions that are sort of entrained in our bodies, some of them we find are based on faulty associations. So I think when we do that and begin to train, we get better responses. And simplistically, too, when you're in a situation, you need to evaluate it properly and then respond. It's like the story of the cardiovascular surgeon who comes in with this boy who's bleeding all over the place, had some sort of wound to the chest, and everybody looks to the cardiovascular surgeon and says, "You only got 5 minutes to save this kid's life. So what are you going to do?" Cardiovascular surgeon looked up and said, "For the first 4 minutes, I'm going to figure out what I'm going to do. And then I'm going to do it really fast." So I think if we have that kind of way of looking at things, we get better results. And a lot of us operate on this sort of rage, anger, react. It's just not the right way to live.
And again, we've gone through all the principles here, and really we have only scratched the surface on what this complete and sort of, in my way of thinking, revolutionary still, worldview has to offer people, especially now when the healthcare system is to me, about to go right for the proverbial iceberg, and you've got people that have to rely on much more, you know, kind of homespun, almost kitchen table wisdom, which your approach has in droves, because it's not something they have to go outside themselves to get. This is about being, I always talk about first-person authority on the show, regaining that first-person authority, feeling capable, and trusting that your system is intelligent enough to adapt to the conditions around it without having to get, you know, poked, prodded, and pickled, you know, in the realm of public health. People look back, I think they hope they look back in 50 years when people were duct-taping their home shut to ward off anthrax as the last kind of kicks and maybe the rigor mortis of the germ theory and the allopathic approach were making the environment the constant enemy and putting the organism in a state of peril basically for a bunch of false alarms, whether it's SARS or whether it's bird flu. Any one of these patterns that come over people is mostly, like you said, because of a poorly adapted system that's not communicating well, that's toxic in and of itself, just on its own self-operating mechanisms. And then when something comes in to challenge it or test it, it can't raise the bar, there's load resistance. And they used to talk about opportunistic infections. They used to talk about that when I was in chiropractic college in the late 80s, that, like, yeast, candida was the big thing back then. Everybody had yeast. And it was like, well, it's a natural occurring thing in the system, but when the environment in the body is you know, conducive to proliferating it, there'll be an opportunistic infection and you get candidiasis. And I was like, wow. They used to say the same thing for common cold. It was an opportunistic infection. Earaches, opportunistic infection. And now that you never hear this anymore, because that would imply that there's something that the organism is doing that would allow these vectors to proliferate, and we've taken that completely out of the language, just like we used to have in guidance that sleep was part of the restoration system. It was right up there. They put sleep and the respiratory system in the same chapter, and it was called the restoration system. I said, what's this? Well, if the system can sleep and repair, then it can breathe and move. Oh, that seemed like a nice loop. Took that right out of the book, segregated it out, and they came out with another edition. So it was like within 3 years of me going to chiropractic college, and they're somewhere in there, they shuffled the chapters again. And it's like I'm fascinated how the fundamentals of anatomy and physiology should be interdisciplinary. It shouldn't matter which way you're applying those things. We should have the same raw materials. But constructing both a delivery system for providers and also for an education for consumers always seems to be a political game. So just kind of to sum up, what do you think is the number one misconception about your book, your work, your approach that you can clear up now, you know, for the audience that maybe tuned in late or just wants to get kind of the overview?
Yes, I like that question. The number one thing is the misconception I want to clear up is that I did not make these up. In fact, I always tell people to read the Pioneers of the Healing Response first, which is a section in the book. What I've done here is made them practical. I brought them into decent English. I've organized them in a way that makes sense. The second thing is this book has been out a few years. You can buy it on Amazon for 99 cents. Barnes & Noble can certainly get it. So what I'm telling you is it's easy enough to find and it's easy enough to read, and it has a glossary. I wanted to have one other thing that I think is huge, and I'm forgetting the author's name. Obviously, Hans Selye, but there's another woman who talks a lot about the stress response. And I confronted her at a recent meeting politely, and I think she's going to change. I said, what you're talking about is the stress response is the acute stress response. That's the reaction. But the response is the healing response. You have an acute stress reaction, which is that just incredibly chaotic, protect, fight, flee kind of reaction. But then it's the healing response that kicks in. So acute stress can be very damaging. It can kick up a lot of cortisol. It can kick up a lot of havoc. But what I'm trying to do is change the language. We have a healing response that will kick in every time your body's challenged or injured to get you better quickly, safely, and completely based on your knowledge, experience, and resources, and it's organized, and you can do something to booster it, and that's what we need to do.
Wow. Well, you know, we kind of touch on that sometimes, and we say we need patience with the CE, and the CE we talked about is coherence education, so that people understand to wait for that transfer from stress to healing and from reaction to response so that they don't polarize and go into suppression and drive that stress reaction internally where it can ricochet through the system and cause more damage. And then when your healing response comes in, you're dealing with all the things you talked about and some of the lower principles there that would distort communication, that would delay resources from being mobilized and ultimately create what then would be called a disease, which is actually just maladaptation.
Yeah.
And again, dealing with H1N1, we're dealing with the fundamental thing of here's the boogeyman, which is I talk about on blogsoma.net if you haven't checked it out yet. It's kind of a four-cheese pizza that has two different strains of human influenza A and a swine flu and a bird flu in there. Then now we're going to create a vaccine to and artificially induce a, would you call it a healing response or a stress reaction in people that are getting exposed to this vaccine?
Well, they may have a stress reaction.
Which would be good.
Because if you wake up tomorrow morning feeling absolutely like crap, you may start doing the wrong thing. You may go to the doctor and get a steroid shot, which is not what you want to do. Mm. I mean, you want to make sure you respond appropriately by increased hydration, increased antioxidants, better air, staying away from social environments. It may give you another dose, because if the dose is large enough, you can really overwhelm your system. But what we need to do is we do not want to be a deer in the headlights, because you got to get out of the way or you're going to get mowed down. In fact, ironically, I think next week there's a new series starting which sounds kind of interesting. It's called How to Survive Catastrophes. And
wow.
Let me tell you, I think that it's listening to the previews of this, I think it's going to be interesting. Because if you do get in a plane crash, or you do get in a guerrilla type of situation, or get car mugged, they're going to teach you how to get out of the way and survive. And I think it's a great idea for a series that's going to maybe give us some common responses instead of just reactions.
Yeah, 20 years ago, that was the genesis of salutogenesis, Antonovsky's work with how people recover from disasters, who was resilient versus who wasn't. It led to his concept of the sense of coherence and being able to manage, comprehend, and ultimately adapt to your surroundings over time. And, of course, the allostatic model, allopathic allostatic, dealt with reaction, or dealt with stress response, not with the proactive consciousness you're talking about. So, again, the swine flu is there. The swine friend, as I call it, is there for all of us to behold. From our vantage point here, for me and Dr. I'm going to say it again, Lois, or Less, Dr. Less.
Less, Dr. More or Less.
Dr. More or Less, yes. Less is more. You know, our perspective is out there for you guys to explore. You can check them out at healingresponse.com. And, of course, I'm over at somaspace.org. With very similar points of view. And resources there on both sides for you to get going. The book, like you said, is only a buck. You can buy, you know, 10 of them for your friends and family and educate everybody about these principles so that they can go in to their allopathic physicians, to their pediatricians this fall when they try to stick their kids with this vaccine and say, you know, it says here that, you know, toxins are, and just for once make the system accountable to itself. I'd love to see a stress reaction on that side of the street just for a change. Be nice.
Okay.
See if they have it in them, you know. All right, so thanks for joining us tonight here in Somatime. We'll get you the MP3 of this. Any questions or comments, get a hold of me or Dr. Less at nakedsoma@gmail.com. And I wish you well. I know you're off to Boston for a conference, and you know, travel light, as we say, and we'll be in touch.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
All right, so there it is. Dr. Less is more going at it there. And what does Elvis have to say about that? Let's see.
There's two things you need to know. I'm the king. And number two is, look out, man!
Yeah, okay. And just to sum it up, we have Dewey Cox trying to sum up what we talked about all night tonight.
What the fuck was he talking about?
There you go. Anyway, next week we're going to get into some personality psychology with Dr. Sam Gosling from Austin, Texas, who was in this month's, it's next month, October's, Psychology Today, to talk about a little domains next week. So we're going to get into a little mind map on Somatime finally after about 2.5 years of skirting the issue. So hopefully this hour gave you some ways to kind of look at the pandemic that is upon us, the plague on the planet and all that, with a fresh eye. Go out there tomorrow with your healing response tucked under your little thymuses and, you know, tell them to stick that shot. You ain't getting it, Obama or not. And we'll look for you next week. So let's see if we can punch up a little song here to take us out. If I could find my Napster. That's it. I'm going to go with a little Sheryl Crow here to... maybe a little Blondie? No, we'll go Sheryl Crow. Yeah, because that gets us into, you know, what's going on down south there in New Orleans. There. And, watch out, man. First of all, Napster has to work. And Napster's not working. Oh, wait a minute. There we go. Let's see if we can pot it up here. Hello. All right. So, again, any questions, get a hold of me at nakedsoma@gmail.com. And we'll be back next week at 9 o'clock Eastern for Soma Time. Until then, this is Dr. Mark saying thank you for this time in your space. Travel light, my sapiens. Shell's a little scratchy. Check her throat here. Just swab her out. There we go. Hey! Thank you.
Babylon.